Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sake Revolution. This is America's first sake podcast, and I am your host, John Puma from the Sake Notes, also the administrator over at the Internet Sake Discord, your one-stop shop for all chit-chat sake-related. And around these parts, I'm the guy who gets excited about the sake. That's not true. We both get excited about the sake.
And I am your host, Timothy Sullivan. I'm a sake samurai, sake educator, as well as the founder of the Urban Sake website. And every week, John and I will be here tasting and chatting about all things sake and doing our best to make it fun and easy to understand.
That is right, Tim. And I believe we were a little overdue. At least that's what my notes say. We're a little overdue for a guest.
Yes, we are going to have a VIP again in the studio today. And we're going back to our series on American sake brewers.
Excellent. That is that might be one of our first series, maybe our second series, but it was one of the originals of when we first started doing this. And yes, for me, being an American, an exciting one.
Yes. Well, let me introduce our guest. We are so excited today to welcome Steve Volstek to the show. He's a native of Oregon, and he has grown up in the wine business and has worked in many aspects of the wine industry, from production to sales and marketing, to even leading wineries as a CEO. Over the years, he has also served as a board member or board president on numerous committees, associations, and coalitions working hard to promote craft beverages from Oregon. In 2009, Steve took on a new challenge and became the president and CEO of Oregon's Sake One Sake Brewery. Steve, we're so happy to have you on. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much. Great to be here. Always like to talk about this Nihonshu that we spend a lot of our time with if you're in my position. So absolutely. Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, that's good because if you weren't ready to talk about sake, we'd be in a little bit of trouble. Tim mentioned in your introduction that you went from working in wine and then later moved on to sake. So what brought that transition on?
Well, I was born and raised in Oregon wine. Literally, my parents founded one of the original pioneer wineries in the state in 1970. There were four wineries. I was 10 years old. So after school, I'd come home and put labels on wine bottles. And it was kind of the cool thing to do if you're sixth or seventh grade. That evolved to studying business, getting a degree, really in business. That's what my family winery needed. And then really embarked on the mission of trying to establish a place in the globe wine market for Oregon wine. And of course, back then, there wasn't an industry per se, and people didn't know even that wine was made in Oregon. So as I got out of college and started doing sales and marketing for the company, then eventually ran the company for 14 years, I got to work alongside many of the pioneers, the David Letts, Dick Ponzi, Dickie Rath, and a host of others, even though I was second generation. So really got to be out in the market, trying to convince people to drink a beverage that they really didn't know a lot about. A variety of Pinot Noir they didn't know a lot about. But I think you might say the rest is history, because there's about 900 wineries now in the state of Oregon. And of course, hard to find a wine list without an Oregon Pinot Noir on it. But I really wasn't planning to leave the wine business. I was managing another pioneer winery, Erath Winery. Did that for about 6 years. And then the owner, Dick Erath, sold the winery. My position became kind of redundant. So I did some different things, consulting, and then I was managing a custom crush winery for a year and a half, but it really wasn't the same. And you know, Oregon is made up mostly of small family wineries, and Erath was quite sizable. So there really wasn't a role for me to just slide into. And so by happenstance, a recruiter called me and said, hey, if you're looking for something, I got something that might be interesting for you. And so I said, well, what are you talking about? And he said, well, I can't really tell you what it is. All I can tell you is it's an adult beverage company. That sounds kind of dirty almost.
The first rule was he wasn't allowed to talk about it. And the second rule was he wasn't allowed to talk about it.
Yeah. So Anyway, I eventually pieced together what he was talking about. And I thought, you know, that's interesting. I didn't know a lot about sake at the time. I'd actually came here a couple of times. In fact, one of my growers who was growing grapes for me was the general contractor that built Sake One. I actually toured the facility. Mm. He took me over. He drove me over here. It's literally 9 miles from my house. That was another nice thing. And he toured around, and I was looking around going, what is this cedar-lined room right here in the middle of the koji? Is it a sauna for the employees? And so what a crazy happenstance that, that was 1997. And then I started here in 2009. So who would have, I never would have dreamed that I'd take on this endeavor of running, America's original craft sake brewery.
Yeah.
But I jumped in with both feet and talk more about the company. So.
Wow. Awesome. So you got headhunted for sake. I love that. So, you know the wine industry really well, and of course now you know the sake industry well. I'm curious to ask you, from your point of view, what do you think are the biggest differences between the way the wine industry works and the way the sake industry works?
Well, the first thing I've told people, because believe me, a lot of people said, do you really like what you're doing now? And I said,
damn.
I said, yeah, I do. I've been here 12 years.
That's rough.
But actually, in some ways, when you're managing a sake brewery, of course, no different than a winery, you're managing, how much product do I make? How do I forecast it? How do I get people to get interested in it? You know, all the things that you have to do. And, after managing wineries for so many years, I found that in the world of sake, because unlike wine, where you get one chance a year to make your wine in the fall at harvest, we brew year round. So it actually is much more conducive to managing and projecting sales and projecting how much you need to make. So it's not like that. I always said, projecting wine sales is like you got a dartboard and you're throwing a dart trying to figure out, how many grapes should I buy? Should I grow? How much wine should I make? Because with wine, in some of the varieties, particularly Pinot Noir, you're not just making it, selling it the next day. It's, there's a time difference there. So really what I found initially was, I jumped in. I needed to understand all the idiosyncrasies that go into making fine sake. I knew that once it was in the bottle, we sell through much of the same channels that we do for wine.
Interesting.
The same network of distributors for the most part. So that part was really the easier part. Although not unlike trying to get a distributor to really get behind selling Oregon Pinot Noir in the early days, trying to get a distributor behind sake, which is like a quarter of 1% of the wine market. So it's a tiny slice, but our job is get the distributor excited about it and hopefully move on from there.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Cool.
Tell us a little bit more about Sake One. I think that one of the unique aspects of this company is that not only do you guys produce sake in Oregon, but you also import, which is a little unusual for the craft sake scene in the United States. So tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, the company was really founded with the idea that it would be the first to really focus on Ginjo grade sake. There was plenty of sake being made in California, but primarily Junmai, with the primary focus being to serve as warm sake in Japanese restaurants. So the idea of kind of going up to that next level of quality and of course, the whole concept of serving and promoting chilled sake was new. So I certainly commend the founders, Toru Murai, who was the CEO of Momokawa Brewing of Japan, at the time, 33rd largest sake brewery in Japan, located up in the Aomori prefecture, up in the northern part of Honshu, the island. And then a local entrepreneur, Griff Frost, who by happenstance met Toru in Japan and they struck up a friendship. So they really had kind of the genesis of the idea of, is the American market ready for better quality sake. And, you know, the company was really founded in 1992. However, the brewery didn't get completed until about 1997. So they actually, the company actually imported sakes from Momokawa Brewing of Japan in those early years and kind of got their feet wet. So the company actually started as an import company, but the real direction was for it to be a craft brewery. It's almost embarrassing to say, but it was probably a little bit ahead of its time then. Mm-hmm. Because even when I started in 2009, I'd run across people that had all these misnomers about what they thought sake was. Yeah. One, of course, it's only served warm or as a sake bomb, or two, oh, all sake is made in Japan. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, great. This is like trying to sell Oregon Pinot Noir all over again. You know, to like, you have to educate people about what we're doing, why we're doing it, and why should someone drink sake made in Oregon?
It was interesting. You mentioned that you thought the idea of building this brewery and making Ginjo sake in the U.S. was maybe a little bit before its time. But in the past few years, we've really seen growth in the domestic sake brewing industry. A lot of breweries are opening up each year, and kind of putting the pandemic and all that aside for a moment, what do you think are the consumer trends and kind of the sake industry trends that you've been seeing in the last couple years kind of tied to this growth overall in new breweries popping up?
Well, I think to a great extent, we owe the interest, the growing interest in the fact that some of the emerging demographics that are drinking, you know, once you turn 21, maybe between 21 and 35, if you will, they're not like sort of my generation, but maybe my parents' generation, where maybe you only drank, you know, gin and tonic or whiskey or, you know, you drank beer. You really didn't bounce around and try a lot of different beverages. And the younger demographics in America certainly are very open to experimenting with different beverages. And I don't think our company our company has done a tremendous job, I think, of educating in America, but it really takes more than one company. Mm-hmm. And I think when you start looking at how the craft beer industry has evolved, where they're making every kind of beer on the planet, lots of experimentation. It's interesting, you know, when I joined sake, when I think we thought that we needed to convince wine drinkers to drink sake, and we sort of pounded our heads in that direction for a long, long time. And then we started figuring out that, wait a minute, the consumers are like beer, like lots of different types of beer. They always like the new things that are coming out from these craft mm-hmm. brewers. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of dovetailed into, wait a minute, we need to really engage maybe more of the beer drinkers, younger mm-hmm. ones especially. And we found a very willing audience. And so that was very enlightening. And I think, you know, we certainly, being sort of the old guard, if you will, of craft brewers in America, craft sake brewers, we had a lot of people stopping by, asking questions, mm-hmm. a lot of these small startups. And they're just sowing those little seeds of interest in the category locally, which we did here in the Portland area. And the per capita consumption of sake here in Oregon is in the highest in the country. So wow. We know once you put a good product out there, people get excited about it for all the reasons that we all know about sake. So it's fun to, you know, open the doors and see what happens.
Mm. So on that topic, tell us a little bit about the sake that you guys are producing domestically, you know, brands and styles. Tim and I, I'm sure, have had quite a few experiences with them, but I want you to kind of tell our listeners what they should be looking out for.
Oh, you bet. Well, because the company was founded by the family that had Momokawa Brewing of Japan, they made the decision early on that the primary flagship brand, they would use the Momokawa name here in America. So that's been the flagship brand since day one, since the first batches in 1997. Geez, I say that and I go, that's It's like almost 25 years ago that we've been brewing. It's, it's quite something. So that brand remains our flagship. And we do make a variety of styles under the Momokawa brand, from a sort of a dry tokubetsu junmai style to technically they're all junmai ginjos because they're all polished to 58% before brewing. But then we've got our diamond junmai ginjo is our top selling sake. Mm-hmm. It's that not dry, not sweet, just very well balanced, kind of a jack of all trades sake for us. That's what we introduce people to if they've never had it, just mm-hmm. to see where they are. And then we do it in Nigori called Pearl. We have two organic junmai ginjos, one clear, one Nigori. We are USDA certified organic as well. Oh, and then a couple years ago, we started releasing actually two sakes in cans. So we've got a Momokawa Junmai Ginjo and then a new brand called Yomi. The other brand that was started very early on was Moonstone. To our knowledge, sake land, we were the first sake brewery to actually infuse, in our case, a Junmai Ginjo sake and then infuse it with natural essences, Asian pear, plum, coconut lemongrass. Through the years, early on, they actually had a hazelnut, peach. Mm-hmm. We've tried some different other things, but really, I think the necessity there was to, we know when people come by our tasting room, a lot of them, it's the first time they'd ever been to a sake tasting room. And for many of them, never had sake outside of maybe that warm sake in a Japanese restaurant. Yeah. So these were sort of like entry levels, giving them some elements of the beverage that they could kind of go, oh, I get that pear flavor. Oh, mm-hmm. this, and it's kind of has sake sort of in the background. And then our G brand was started in about 2007. And the idea was we would make something very American looking and American tasting. The G stands for Genshu, against Junmai Ginjo, but at 18%, it really provided more of that bold, in-your-face type of style that we always think about, you know, what kind of foods we as Americans eat versus, say, the Japanese would eat. And, you know, our flavors tend to be much bolder. You think about barbecue and spice elements and such. So the G sake really is one that can really stand up to those bolder flavors. And that was sort of the idea behind it. Also, we came up with a very unique package. You wouldn't probably mistake it for anything that came from Japan. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of our, you know, let's kind of wave the American flag and say, this is something that's different, but still follows a tradition of Japanese sake brewing, if you will.
Great. Awesome. Well, thank you for that overview of all the different brands you have, but it would not be an episode of Sake Revolution if we did not have a tasting. So we've asked you to prepare one of your very special bottles, and this is a sake that John and I also got our hands on. And we would love to taste this with you and have a little back and forth about a little bit how it came to be. And let me introduce this sake. We're going to be tasting the Naginata Junmai Daiginjo. This is a sake made with Yamada Nishiki grown in Arkansas, milled to 40% remaining. The alcohol is 15.5, and we have an SMV, that sake meter value, of +2. Now, before we pour the sake and taste it, we have to talk about this bottle. Our listeners can look at our show notes and see a photo of the bottle, but tell us about this very unique bottle and label and design for this. How did that come about?
Well, of course, the idea of the sake came way before the bottle. And we have been working, I would say, for at least 3 or 4 years before we finally said, okay, we can hang our hat on this sake. The brewery was set up really as a Ginjo brewery. So I think my confidence level went up way high 3 years ago when we were fortunate to have a new Toji arrive, Takumi Kurabara. Spent time both in Japan and in California brewing, had over 25 years of brewing experience. And so we had been trying to first of all, find Yamada Nishiki rice that we could start with on this Daiginjo project. And interestingly, besides the rice from Arkansas, there's also Yamada Nishiki now grown in California. Mm-hmm. So we brewed a whole bunch of different test batches, very small batches, tried different mill rates, 50, 45, 40, different yeasts. And finally we said, oh, this is it. And so, of course, we wanted to have a bottle that really set it apart. And so we wanted, you know, Americans, I think for the most part, when you look at a bottle like what the Naginata is in, might think more spirits than sake, but we wanted to find a very unique shape and a unique color and a unique presentation that really said this is crap in spades. You would never think that this was mass produced, and it's certainly not. We make like 600 bottles at a time, so it's very, very small production. Takumi comes in every single day, like 40 days in a row. He's always checking all the specs. So the name Naginata is actually, it's a Japanese pole sword, if you will, a sword on the end of a pole, which was primarily used by women in Japan. So we kind of thought that name sort of has some interesting significance, because you might say, we're a sake brewer here in America, and we're making what we think is a sake comparable to what's made in Japan. And so we can kind of poke the Japanese a little bit with our Naginata sword. But we, of course, the proof is in the pudding, so to speak. Yeah. And we are delighted the way that the sake turned out. I certainly want to give a tip of the hat to Chris Isbell, who is the grower of the rice in Arkansas. I could go on and on, but Chris actually sold rice to Sake One back in 1997.
Oh, wow.
It was not Yamada Nishiki. It was medium grain Arkansas rice. But that really failed, because when Sake One started, they thought, we're going to have our own grain silo, and we're going to do everything. We're going to mill it, take the hulls off and everything. And that's a whole thing unto itself. So long story short, Chris took an interest in growing Japanese sake rice a number of years ago. And so I've had the pleasure of going and seeing his rice farm in town outside the town of England, Arkansas, of all places. And so between the name and the bottle and, of course, the liquid, we were just excited to put something out that we think represents some of the best sake ever made in America.
With that buildup, we have to get it in the glass right
now. We definitely do.
So we're going to go ahead and pour this. Beautiful aroma.
Yeah.
It's very gentle and super balanced. The fruits that come through are soft, and there's a hint of floral notes as well.
Yes. A lot of nice fruit on this. A lot of that melon that we love to talk about.
Yep. Ripe melon. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's not wafting from the other room. It is in the room with you.
No. Very, very, I call this type of aroma restrained elegance. Mm. It's like, doesn't overpower or come off too perfumed, but just the right amount to engage your senses and get you started. I just love it. Really good.
Mm, thank you. You know, I sometimes catch myself going, there's some real parallels between this style of sake and really good Oregon Pinot Noir, because it's easy. It's almost easy to make a wine that's got a really big nose to it. Lots of, you know, just billows out of the glass. But if you want to enjoy it all the way through, restraint and elegance has a place. And I found it interesting the comments you made about the nose, because I use those same descriptors for the palate impression. And to me, great Pinot Noir is really about how the texture is on the palate. And a sake like this, it just feels good in your mouth, on your palate, as a sake gets absorbed.
All right, let's give it a sip. Very smooth.
Yeah.
And I'm finding it has just a touch, just a note of sweetness on the front palate, and it finishes nice and dry, but it's not starting dry. There's a fullness and a richness. Those wonderful fruit flavors come through, but it gives me just a slight note of sweetness at the beginning, and then it finishes balanced and dry. Just really, really lovely, super premium flavor.
Yeah.
Really, really good.
And thank you.
That dry finish is something that we like to talk about on the show as being something that becomes inviting again for your next sip. Mm. It's kind of resetting you, and then you get to go on the journey all over again. It doesn't hang around. It leaves you, when it leaves you with that dry finish, it really cleans the palate, leaves it an open field for you to your next bite of food, your next sip of sake. Really nice for that.
Absolutely. You know, that's spot on. If it's too heavy, if you will, in the finish, then I personally like the length. It does have length, but it doesn't just, it's not hanging on your palate. It does. You feel the drying on your palate, and that's exactly what we had in mind when we think about, you know, food pairings.
And speaking of food, what do we think about pairings with this? I know this is a Daiginjo, and sometimes people like to kind of make this more of a sipping thing. You know, it's well documented that I have my couch I like to sip sake on, not necessarily eating while I do that. But, you know, we do have to give some credit to the pairings.
Well, I'll throw a couple things out there.
Please.
For sure. I mean, the first one that comes to mind, being from the Pacific Northwest, is some really good, like, king salmon. Mm. That's done well. I mean, the king salmon, a little higher oil content in the fish, certainly rich, but you can, if it's, and to me, I'm a stickler, you don't want to overcook it. You know, if it's cooked properly, then I think a sake like this with that little bit of dryness in the finish really is a good foil for cutting through the oily texture of the salmon. So that immediately comes to mind.
Mm. Tim, what about you?
Hmm. Well, this sake has really good balance and really good incorporation of the sweetness, the alcohol, and the acidity. They're just in harmony. I think of sakes like this as a stool with three legs. If one of them was out of balance, you'd fall off the mm-hmm. stool. But this one keeps you supported in a really wonderful position. And when I have a sake like this, I think of more pure pairings, like sashimi, because it's more about the freshness of the ingredients, or that type of a purity really lets the food shine. Sashimi is something that really popped to mind when I was sipping this, and something that's delicate and really showcases the ingredients.
I really love the idea of that salmon. I'm leaning a little bit more with the light of sashimi because I really want to cherish this. I really love the flavor with this. I don't want to do anything that's going to be it's going to be too strong. I'm always very skittish when it comes to my pairings. I'm always very nervous about introducing anything too strong with it. I would personally lean lighter, but that's just because I'm a wuss about that sort of thing.
Well, I guess I'm, you know, I've always been a promoter of my region. So bear with me for putting the salmon in there. But I tell you, one of those memorable meals I've had was in Hachinohe in Aomori. The brewery there, they make some of the best daiginjos in Japan. And they had a very exclusive one. I was at a meal there one evening, and they had it with sashimi scallops from Aomori. And oh my goodness, that was a match made in heaven. Ooh, absolutely.
Nice.
Because of the pristineness of those fresh scallops with that just wonderful match with the daiginjo.
Fantastic. Well, this has been such a pleasure. It's been great to talk to you about your background, how you got into sake, what's been going on with your brewery, and to taste this amazing ultra-premium sake with you. It's been just fantastic. So thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. I love where sake is going in this country as a category, whether it's what we make or what we import. This last year, we've had a watershed year. And I think, you know, what's interesting, it's not just pockets of interest now in sake, like in New York or Los Angeles or San Francisco or Portland, Oregon. Last year, 48 out of the 50 states that we sell in had big increases in sake. Mm. 48 out of 50. So I won't name the two states that we're different, but it really speaks to, I think, the emergence of this category and the fact that folks can find out about it much easier than maybe 20 years ago, mm-hmm. you know, with social media, with the internet, it's easier to get your head wrapped around what it is. So I applaud both you and Tim for hosting me and having this forum, because this is what it's all about. Getting more people interested and excited about it, because I never dreamed that sake would have such a profound effect on my career and my ability now to just be able to wax about it. It's always a pleasure. So thank you for the opportunity.
All right. Now, before we go, if our listeners want to learn more about Sake One, where can they find you online? Where should they go?
Pretty simple. Sakeone.com. SAKEONE.com. We've got a brand new website coming out in about 2 weeks, but do check us out. We really do a lot of work to educate through our site. So even if you're kind of a neophyte to sake, you can learn the basics and then just take off from there.
Fantastic. Well, Steve, thank you so much, and I also want to thank our listeners as well for tuning in. We really do hope that you're enjoying our show. If you would like to show your support for Sake Revolution, the best way to support us now is to join our community on Patreon. We're a listener-supported show, and all the support we receive from our patrons allows us to host, edit, and produce a podcast for you every week.
And if you'd like to know more about the Patreon, you can go ahead and visit patreon.com/sakerevolution. You can also support us by doing things like leave a review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast platform of choice. That really goes a long way towards spreading the word about Sake Revolution. You know what else does too? Telling your friends, tell your family. If they're interested in getting into sake a little bit, tell them you know this show where they can learn a lot about it.
And as always, if you would like to know more about any of the topics or the individual sakes we talked about in any of our episodes, please be sure to visit our website, sakerevolution.com, for all the show notes and a transcript of each and every episode.
And if you'd like to reach out to us directly, or if you've got a sake question, burning sake question that you need answered, we want to hear from you. We've got an email address set up for that. It's feedback@sakerevolution.com. And you can also slide into our DMs on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. On Instagram, we are Sake Revolution Pod. Everywhere else, we're just Sake Revolution. So, until next time, please remember to keep drinking sake and... Kanpai!